So we're coming now to my favorite part of the event, which is when I get to answer your questions. Many of you have been here before, you know the format. You can ask anything you want, whether it's investing related or how Andreas and I think about investing, the companies are investing, or for that matter, anything else. The floor is yours. So we have three microphones in circulation. If you'd like to pose a question, please just raise your hand. But please also raise your hand while we're responding so we can get the microphone in place for the next question so we don't lose too much time. Great. So who would like? Oh, Paolo, you already have the microphone, so you can kick us off.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you for organizing this meeting. Every year, more people, and every year, more successful. Congratulations.
Thank you, Paolo.
Just a quick question about an update on credit acceptance. What can you tell us about credit acceptance?
Just an update? Yeah, so Credit Acceptance is a company we've owned for probably around about 10 years. It's a company we love. We love the owner-operator managers there. For those of you less familiar with it, they provide subprime loans for automobiles in the US. And what makes them very unique is that they guarantee acceptance. So anyone can go in there and get a loan. And you'd ask yourself, well, how on earth can that work? And you know, they've developed a system, a big part of which is aligning the incentives of the dealer with the customer, which allows them to do that. And it's really a wonderful business, which has done very well for us over a long period of time. If I look at the last 5 years, there's been a very odd sort of period with lots of unusual things happening. So they had an incredible boom during COVID, where thanks to stimulus checks, people staying at home, not being able to go out and spend money, the performance of the loans was way, way better than they could have ever possibly imagined. They had extraordinary profits then. And then in 2022, we had this huge spike in interest rates, in the prices of cars. And that cohort of loans has performed very badly, as you know, people have been less able to repay their loans. We're now entering more of a sort of a normalized period, and I think it will manifest very soon that especially you know, the 2022 cohort is becoming less and less important over time as people pay it down, and the 2023, the 2024, and soon to be 2025 cohorts become much more important. So, you know, in the same way I made a prediction last year that Carvana would have an exceptional year this year, I think it's pretty clear that credit acceptance is going to have a pretty exceptional this year from an earnings perspective. What that does to the share price is anybody's guess, but you know, we're long-term fundamental investors, so if we see the companies doing well from an earnings perspective, that makes us happy. One also footnote, the 2022 was by far the worst year they ever had in terms of the loans originated, but importantly, not only were those loans profitable, they also own their cost of capital. So that shows you just how an exceptional a business this is, despite everything that happened, that those loans performed less well than they hoped, but they were still pretty decent loans.
I'm not so familiar with credit acceptance, not because it's bad business or there's anything wrong with it. I've just not looked so much into financial businesses.
So who would like to ask the next question? Does anyone have a mic, or maybe you can raise your hand?
Can you anfangen?
You have it, great.
Yeah, okay. We heard in the last, let's say, weeks that the new president in America wanted to have the Panama Canal.
Was there an
wanted
election?
Wanted to have Canada. Wanted to have Greenland. And I think it will go on. How is your reaction on it?
Well, people sitting where I am are well advised not to be.
I don't ask for how can you prepare, but I ask what do we expect and how can we react?
Well, people sitting in my seat are well advised not to be political, so I'll choose my words carefully. But you know, I think you know, President Trump is clearly an iconoclast. He, you know, breaks with a lot of norms, and that, you know, attracts people who like him, and it also, you know, divides opinions in the other direction as well. But it'll be super interesting from the perspective of a citizen of the world. It'll be interesting to see what happens. Clearly, it's going to change a lot of things, I hope, for the US, but also for the rest of the world, that those changes are for the best. But ultimately, I don't have a strong opinion on how that will play out. The way I think of the world, and I'm sure that won't be a surprise to many of you here in the room, is that we focus on finding great businesses that can thrive irrespective of who the president is and what the policies that he or she enacts. And that's what we continue to do, and we're trying not to pay too much attention to the political world.
Yeah, I think none of our business is going to be dramatically affected by whatever policies that are put in place. And Donald Trump has also a tactic of negotiating deals. So he comes out with a very high demand, and then to get people to negotiate, and I don't know what he will negotiate with Canada or with Greenland or with Panama. We'll see.
It will certainly be interesting.
Hi, Rob. Chandan.
Chandan, hi.
Thanks for inviting me. And it's great to see the meeting being successful every year. So, Aker BP versus IPCO, like, why do you decide to do both? Like, what are the pros and cons you see in either companies? And just tell us why you decided to add rather than more into IPCO than like buy a new position. Thanks.
Yeah, so what often happens, for a long time I worked on my own, and obviously since Andreas is here, we're now two of us, but the way we both approach investing is to dive really deep into companies and sectors before we invest in them. And so that means not just studying the company you're potentially interested in investing in, but also the kind of the suppliers, the customers, the competitors. And it was really as part of that journey that I came across Aker BP. Will was kind enough to connect me with Ash, who is the chairman of IPCO, but also a board member of Aker BP. And it was through him that I learned about Aker BP, but it was also through him that I learned that, although intuitively Aker BP sounds like it could be quite a sort of corporate sort of, big sort of conglomerate type of a business, but I learned it's incredibly entrepreneurially run. I met with the CEO of Aker BP a few months ago, and he told me that when the business started out, he sat down with Mr. Rocker, who's actually the largest shareholder in Aker, and they sort of started with a blank piece of paper along the lines of, okay, what would the ideal company look like? What is all the bullshit we wouldn't want to do, which we see at other companies? So it has an incredibly entrepreneurial culture. It has great shareholders, including the Lundin family. So it was something which I thought would be a great additional company to have in the portfolio. In terms of why there's two as opposed to one, I think it's a sector I'm reasonably new to. I'm quite happy to sort of diversify the bets a little bit. I think Aker BP is a very different sort of animal to International Petroleum. International Petroleum has this very young, enthusiastic team with huge ambitions, huge growth ahead of it, which I'm sure they realize. Aker BP is more of it's also a growing business, but not nearly as fast. But it pays, I think, 12 or 13% dividend yield. So it has, a very much a different sort of, I would say, risk perspective and short, capital return perspective. So it seemed to me like a great sort of addition to the sector.
I would add that also in terms of the asset, there is a totally different risk profile. Like IPC is developing oil sands in Canada, where Aker BP is developing offshore oil in Norway, which is a much lower cost location and a much lower cost asset. So it's less dependent on the oil price. And so it's a different set of outcomes. And I personally have never been opposed to owning two companies if they are good ones in a sector. Like I've owned Microsoft and Google and Apple, which are competitors in the same industry kind of for many years, and I never viewed it as a contradiction.
Yes.
Rob, I wanted to get your opinion on Paycom. What do you think about the business in terms of, there are a lot of competitors, it's a relatively low barrier to entry business, but high switching costs. So what do you think about Paycom, and any updates on Pinduoduo from the last time you posted an audio note on your website about it?
Yeah, so I'll let Andreas answer that, because Paycom is a position that he owns through his accounts. But maybe just to provide some context for everybody, so we file a 13F every quarter, as we're obliged to as SEC-regulated asset managers. And that 13F, up until a few quarters ago, consisted just of positions that that I'd bought for our clients. And since about half a year or so, Andreas has also has his own clients, and so our portfolios tend to be, there's a little bit of overlap, but they tend to be quite different. So it's you can't see from the 13F who bought what, but Paycom was Andreas's investment. So I'll let you respond to that. Yeah.
So it's not an investment in the fund, but I will still elaborate a little bit on it. It's a payroll software company in the US with about 5% market share. The market leader is ADP, and there are a number of smaller companies who are slowly gaining market share, and Paycom is one of them. And they have sold off quite a bit as a result of, let's say, maybe an ill-guided sales strategy. But they are correcting course now, and one could buy the company at a reasonable valuation. Wee bit below 20 times earnings. It has a high percentage of recurring revenues, still a low churn rate, even though that moved up a little bit due to the wrong sales strategy. The head of sales also changed. So there's a lot of change, but they're still growing at 10% despite all the challenges. And my bet is a bit that they will re-accelerate the growth when all these changes are being corrected, or all these problems are being corrected. And from that perspective, at PE of 20 and in a non-capital intensive industry, it's a good bet.
Yeah, and then I'll maybe take the question on Pinduoduo. So the company's official name is PDD Holding, and it's a Chinese e-commerce company, which most of you in the room here, at least the non-Chinese people, will know through their international business. Oops, through their international business, which is called Temu, which I hope everyone is an enthusiastic customer of. I certainly am. You know, I think we invested in it just over a year ago or so. I think it's a wonderful business. They've, it's kind of incredible, and it speaks to how dynamic the Chinese internet is, that, in the same way Amazon is very entrenched in the West, you had two very dominant players in China, and Alibaba and JD, and in the same way, it's almost unimaginable today that anyone could disrupt Amazon. I think people had a similar view of Alibaba in particular, but also JD. And really, out of nowhere, Pinduoduo has become probably almost as big as Alibaba now, and certainly larger in terms of profitability. And they've really done that through rethinking the business by, in particular, the connecting the manufacturers directly with the customers, so which takes out middlemen, allows them to respond more quickly to demand. They have a very sort of algorithmic feed in the app, which allows them sort of to match products with customers, a bit like TikTok does with short videos. So it's really quite an incredible business, and it tends to, the share price tends to be buffeted quite a lot by whatever different political winds are blowing in China or in the West, and that would no doubt continue to be the case. But despite all this, the business is growing at 50-60% per year, massively profitable, a very robust balance sheet with tens of billions of cash. So it's a company we feel very confident owning for the longer run.
I may add that the same merchandise is being promoted on Amazon for a much higher price. So you see all these sponsored listings now on the Amazon marketplace, which is essentially the same manufacturers that are selling on Temu at a much lower price. So I don't quite see why one wouldn't order directly there. So I think it's it has a great future. And of course, there, it's often criticized for the lacking quality, but I think they're an organization that is quickly adapting and making the right changes to appeal to Western customers.
Rob, oh sorry, whoa, this was very loud. Hi.
Hey. Hi, Patsy.
Let's quickly come back to the question on climate change in IPC. I mean, you already alluded to that the midterm, the demand will be driven, midterm and long-term, the demand will be driven quite a lot by emerging economies, which I fully agree, right? By 2050, mm-hmm. like every fourth person on the planet will be African. And that means that midterm, that growth will need to be powered by fossil fuels. However, we already see that Africa is leapfrogging many of the developments. Like there's lots of electric trucks on the road, electric vehicles, etc. Also, lots of renewable energies being built out, some countries being heavily reliant on hydropower. And at the same time, we know that, I mean, 17 out of the 20 countries like hardest hit by climate change are African. So we will not be able to afford for Africa's development to be completely powered on fossil fuels for the next 50 years. What kind of company does IPC need to be in 2050 for you to still want to have it in your portfolio?
Yeah. Well, to be clear, you know, Andreas and I are both believers that, you know, fossil fuels cause climate change, and the sooner the world can get off them, the better. So my expectation or my hope would be that the oil industry is a much smaller one in 50 years than it is today. But even in 50 years, we're going to need oil. There's some things that simply can't be done, or oil and gas, I should say, which simply can't be done in any other way, you know, for example, fertilizers, plastics, and such like. So, you know, I think we're going to need the stuff for a long time. And, you know, everything is in life is a trade-off. You know, you sometimes see people saying, oh, we should, you know, stop oil production today. And, well, you know, humanity would cease to exist if that were to happen, just because how dependent we are on it. So I think it's a very ethical investment to support a company producing something that effectively we need to survive, but at the same time we acknowledge climate change and, you know, hope the world can reduce its dependency over time. In terms of, you know, IPCO as an investment, as Will said earlier on, you know, I think within the next few years they're going to make more cash than their current market cap. So this isn't an investment predicated on a sort of a DCF and a terminal value in 20 years time. You know, we'll probably earn our money back in the next you know, probably 4 or 5 years, and then whatever they own after that will just be money we make on top. Would you agree with that, Will?
I agree as well. So every investment that we are making is a financial decision, and here the financial decision is that it will take more than just 5 years to get rid of oil, and probably more like 20 years or maybe even more. And in that period of time, there are a few companies where you can earn money. But that's not an assessment of the future of the renewable energies, which I think are going to take over in the long run. So I do believe that electric cars will probably dominate, let's say, the European market long before 2035. So this whole discussion about outlawing combustion engines by 2035 is probably completely unnecessary, because it will happen earlier and it will happen without a law.
Yeah. I think you already see in China today, well over 50% of new cars are electric. Is that right, Stephen? Of new cars being sold? Yeah. No, so I mean, it's going to happen, but you know, we're going to make a lot of money from international petroleum well before that day arrives.
Thank you very much for this amazing event. And just a quick question: all we know that at the end, companies are made by people. Do you have a process to evaluate management team? Because as you said, management can also destroy the moat. So I think that management is one of the most important thing in a company. And I was wondering if you have a process or some metrics, let's say. Thank you.
Yeah, we think it's incredibly important. And you know, and the astonishing thing is that although I'm sure if you were to speak to Will or any other person who runs a business, it would be there for, it would be so obvious to them, it wouldn't even be worth mentioning. And yet, when you sit down in sort of more kind of financial investor circles, they think about moats and DCFs and all this kind of stuff, and people is really an afterthought. So I think we have an advantage in that we pay very close attention to it, not because we're smarter, but just because other people, for reasons I don't understand, don't. And then how do we do it? The way I think about it, like a lot of things in life, you know, you have a sort of a normal distribution of people. So you have, you know, most people are sort of average. Then you have like a small minority of very bad people and then a small minority of really exceptional people. And really, you know, trying to figure out amongst all the average people which one is a bit above average or below average, that's not the game we play. We're not able to do that. What we could do is notice when someone is really exceptional, because it just knocks you on the head like a sledgehammer. It's just completely obvious. You see it in things like that. Typically, they have made the business they run their life's work. They live and breathe it. They have a large stake in the business. They know all of their employees, or to the extent it's a smaller company, their employees by name, they know their competitors, their suppliers, everybody know them. So it's really obvious when you find it.
Yeah, I think every company that we have in the portfolio we kind of admire, and the admiration is basically for the management, not for the company. Sometimes the company is so large that we don't have access to management, but you then the company itself is a reflection of what the management does and the values that the management holds. So you can clearly see, you can clearly admire the management by the company they created.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're always told you should be sort of objective and, you know, sort of fact-based or numbers-based. But actually, I think sort of, you know, admiring someone, like you said, is a very sort of visceral, more of a sort of emotional reaction. But for me, it's a very reliable indicator that that you're dealing with good people. Yeah. There's one other person at the front with their hand up. So maybe we can get a microphone here. But next question here.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Thank you very much, guys, for organizing this. And thank you, Rob, for completing your trilogy with the Moat Chat last year. I have a question for each of you. Rob, Ernie Garcia, Trading Extraordinaire. How do you position yourself with a stock that within 24 months does goes from like 4 to 250? How do you change that and how do you rebalance? And for you, Andreas, you're famous for a position in Bijou Bijou, and I'm very curious about jewelry and luxury goods. Can you talk a little bit about the theme of it, the demand in China, and independent producers versus like the larger groups like Richemont and LVMH?
You want to go first?
I didn't get the entire question. I think it was a question on Bijou Brigitte, which is not a luxury good, it's a
Jewelry.
Jewelry.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, even they're selling fashion jewelry. I owned a small position for a couple of years, but I sold now. And
What is the question exactly?
The question was more geared toward that sort of consumer goods and going into the luxury segment.
Yeah, I looked a little bit at the luxury segment, not focused on jewelry, but on different luxury goods. I didn't invest yet. It has sold off quite a bit, but most of the companies have significant exposure to China without this being reflected completely in the valuations. And that made me a bit uneasy. But this can change in the future, and maybe there are some around that don't have so much exposure to China. I'm looking at a few.
Well done for knowing about Andreas's investments from when he was a small kid. Yeah, and then you asked about Carvana, which is a marketplace for used cars in the US, which we've been owners of for several years, and it's been an incredible roller coaster. I think the first stake I bought in it was when the share price was quite high, so definitely not my finest moment as an investor. But subsequent to that, I added to it on several occasions when the share price was very low, and those may well have been some of my finest moments as an investor. But in terms of the share price, we try not to pay too much attention to charts. You know, the share price went from 300 or 400 to you know, almost zero at one point, and now it's gone from 4 or 5 all the way back up to 200. So if you just compare the price today with the price of 3 or 4 years ago, you probably say, oh, this hasn't really done very much. what we're laser focused on is the business, and there it's just such an exciting opportunity. I think there was a question mark even a year ago about whether this business fundamentally works. You know, can you sell cars profitably over the internet? The question mark was never, do people love it? I mean, people of course much prefer clicking a mouse and getting a car delivered to their doorstep than going to a dealer and negotiating and, you know, being ripped off and all that kind of stuff. So the customers always loved it. The question was whether the unit economics work, and they very, very clearly do. And if anything, I think some of the criticism now is it may be too profitable, which is quite a turnaround compared to where we were a year ago. But you know, their market share is now 1%, and it's such an order of magnitude better customer experience than using sort of offline retailers. There's no reason in the long term why that shouldn't go to, well, online penetration shouldn't go to, you know, well over 50%, as indeed it has done in other e-commerce verticals. And then the question is, well, if it's going to be such a huge market, are there any other competitors? And, you know, as tough as 2022 was, the big benefit was that because people didn't believe in the business, all of the competitors had funding pooled, exited the market. So it really looks like this could be, you know, something quite close to a monopoly for the foreseeable future. So that combination of a very, very dominant market position in combination with this very low online penetration of the market is very, very exciting. And, you know, the valuation is quite high today compared to what it's going to earn this year or maybe even next year. But you only need to look out sort of 2 or 3 years and all of a sudden it looks very, very cheap. So, you know, it's a company we plan to own for a long time.
Can I follow up actually with book recommendations? Because last year you recommended Bloodlands, which is a tough topic, but a really good read. Any book recommendations this year?
Yeah, I just finished actually over Christmas reading a book on Bretton Woods. I forget the exact name, but the title includes Bretton Woods. So I'm sure you'll find it as one of the first results on Amazon. And it's kind of fascinating. Especially seen through the lens of today, because obviously, you know, Bretton Woods, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, was a conference which was held towards the end of the Second World War, where the war wasn't over, but it was kind of clear that the Allies were going to win. So all of the Allied powers, so basically the entire world except Japan and Germany, sort of met in Bretton Woods to discuss what trade and the monetary system should look like in the post-Second World War world. And so you had, you know, these 40 countries come together, a diverse bunch of countries, as you can imagine, obviously UK, US, but also, you know, communist China, USSR. But amongst all of these disparate participants, there was a complete consensus that it was tariffs and protectionism that led to the Great Depression, and it was the Great Depression that led to the Second World War. And as a result of that, they sat down at Bretton Woods and designed a system which encouraged sort of open borders, open trade, as a means to create prosperity, but also to secure the peace. And, you know, seen through today's perspective, it's kind of amazing that, you know, protectionism and tariffs seem to be back in fashion, and everyone thinks that they're going to solve all problems, because the historical record shows actually the opposite. Any books you've read today?
What I spent a lot of time on last year was listening to Acquired podcasts. I'm a big fan of them, and they deal with nice companies. Like there is a very good podcast on Meta, on Microsoft, on Deere, on LVMH, and these are two people discussing the business. They are incredibly well prepared, and each podcast lasts for maybe 4 or 5 hours. And it's a great listen in the car or whatever during sport or whatever. It's get so much information out of them.
I'm a big fan too. Yeah.
Yeah. So understand you solved your jurisdiction problem with the fund, and that you will receive some new investors in the fund. I'm just thinking about how are you planning, or how would you do, say that tomorrow you have an inflow of new cash to the fund that's relatively big. Let's put just big numbers, $200, $500 million of new cash, which would dilute the current investors, no? With new cash, but it's fine. how would you allocate that? Would you think about allocating proportionally to the new, to the current companies, look for new opportunities? Like, what effect do you think will have that for current investors, for future investors? Like, I would like to have, know how you think about this.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So I think the question was, what would I do if there was a huge inflow of cash all of a sudden into the fund? I think the important point to make is that that couldn't happen because I control whether people can invest or not. And, you know, I would for sure not want all of a sudden such a large amount of money to come into the fund and dilute everybody. So I can certainly reassure you that won't happen. But if the question is a sort of a hypothetical one, what would I do if I sort of suddenly had a huge amount of cash? The way I think about it is more like an individual as opposed to sort of a fund manager. You know, imagine, you know, you have a wealthy uncle who sadly passes away and leaves you a bunch of money. I don't think your reaction would be, oh, I better buy all the stocks I own as quickly as possible. I think your reaction would be, oh, this is a lot of money. Let's have a think about what I should do with it. And I think that's the way I would approach it as well. And I wouldn't sort of mechanically buy everything I own. I would think about where my best ideas are. If the money creates opportunities to do things which I potentially previously hadn't been able to do, you know. So I think that's how I'd approach it. What about you?
Well, I can only talk. It's a similar situation with my customers. They gave me money. I didn't invest it all on day one. Just waited as opportunities came along, and I think that's the best approach. To not lose money, not buy something that is maybe not as exciting anymore. And just wait for opportunities, and even if there's a little bit of cash around. I mean, we aim to be fully invested, but that's different from always being fully invested. So aiming for full investment means we look for opportunities and will not deliberately hold some cash. But if we don't find opportunities, obviously we will hold some cash for some time until we find the opportunities.
Normally we find something, but we don't mind if there's a bit of cash in the fund at any moment in time. But it's never a macro call. We don't have an opinion on whether the market's going up or down or whatever. We're just waiting until we find the right opportunity.
Hi, Rob and Andreas. So I have a question on temperament and maintaining emotional stability through volatile times. The last time I was here was 2022, and I think the room, the emotions in the room were quite different than after the very strong year you had this past year, but you both seem pretty much the same. And I'd love to hear how you guys think about managing and regulating your own emotions and how that helps you to make good decisions.
Yeah, maybe I'll take this one and you can chime in, but you know, 2022 was a very tough year, and I don't want to like mask that in any way. Both in terms of, you know, having such a big drawdown in the fund, and also having a health emergency. So that was definitely not the most fun year of my life. But you know, as you correctly say, we still at the, I think it was beginning of 2023 would have been the meeting you're referring to, and it was still a great meeting. I thought the atmosphere was good, and everyone was like they are today, happy to be together. So that was incredibly reassuring. And I would say that also sort of leads into the answer about temperament. I think I have a good temperament. I hope I have a good temperament, but whether I do or not, I can't be 100% sure, because what really helps is creating an environment which allows you to remain relatively even-tempered, irrespective of what's happening around you. And you know, I work for many years by myself, and now with Andreas, whereby we're not in the office together every day. We have our own offices. We probably together once or twice a day. So the main contacts I have on the day-to-day basis are my children, Tommy, who's just picked up the microphone, my wife, and that's a great way just to kind of keep a sort of a stable mood, even when sort of the world is sort of tough outside. So for me, that's been incredibly important. And I really learned that lesson actually in 2008 in the financial crisis. So when I started RV Capital in 2006, I didn't have a whole lot of money. And so I worked from home more sort of out of necessity rather than out of any sort of strategic master plan. But it was kind of fascinating in 2008, when of course the world was sort of falling apart, or seemed to be falling apart, a lot of people sort of really sort of panicked panicked and did really dumb things. And I managed to sort of remain relatively calm. And I think what enabled me to do that was simply just living in a relatively stable environment. My children still went to kindergarten in the morning. We still had lunch together and dinner together. And so, you know, I think creating that sort of stable environment for yourself is incredibly important. And a big part of that is, of course, the investors. You know, if you have hundreds of investors screaming at you and redeeming their capital, then, you know, that would for sure negatively impact you. But I'm very fortunate to have investors who are very loyal, very supportive, including in 2022. And I have a big thanks for that.
I think it's always important to focus on facts. When a share price declines a lot, and I saw that with Meta, also with other stocks, all kinds of negative articles come out in the press, which seem to confirm that the decline is justified. But whoever writes these articles is just cherry-picking the part of the picture that supports the way that the stock price is going. So the trick is to either not read these articles at all, or to deliberately ask yourself after every paragraph that you read, what are really the facts that are communicated in this paragraph? Are they irrefutable? Are they clear? Or is this just an opinion based on what the share price has recently done? And it's so important to focus on the facts. If you looked at the data that Meta put out, during the decline, the usage of the apps didn't decline. They actually went up, or at least flatlined. So there was no basis in assuming that the company is going to hell in a handbasket. And if necessary, they could have easily cut off the metaverse and the reality labs and restored their former profitability. So, but it all focused on this small segment, all of the press attention focused on that small segment, and it's just important to isolate yourself from it. From an enterprise value perspective, it's maybe influences 5% of the total value of the company, not more. But 80%, what was written on Meta was focusing on these 5%. And you see that time and again when companies have a big decline, people assume that management can never correct these mistakes that they made, even if they made a mistake, I'm not even sure. And bad times will continue forever. Markets tend to extrapolate recent news forever.
Yeah, whenever there's a share price decline, you can be guaranteed there'll be someone with a negative article about the company. I saw that the last few weeks on Novo Nordisk. It's been probably, for sure, the most successful large company in Europe for many decades. And, you know, they had, you know, some slightly negative results on one of their GLP-1 studies. And, of course, you know, the share price is down and everyone's talking about how it's no longer a great business. And, yeah, you see it the whole time.
Yeah, I have a question around position sizing, and it's more, if you take an investment, do you make it a fixed position, or on the outset, do you decide on a position size, and as the stock moves, especially up, do you add more to it? And the second part of the question is if you like a company for the long term, but something happens in the short term, like say, you know that the business climate is going to be challenging for the next 2 years. Do you sell some of the position in order to buy it later at a cheaper price? Like, how do you change your sizing around? I know that you have conviction and you like to buy it when it's cheaper. You like more of it when it's cheaper.
Yeah, so I think there's a few questions in there. In terms of sizing, you know, I've really done things the same way since when my earliest days of investing. So when I started investing, I had very little money, and every now and again a really good idea. And so when I had a good idea, I wanted to really move the needle on my net worth. But I didn't want to like risk the, you know, kind of risk the whole farm. So, you know, what I came out at was back then, if I had a really good idea, I'd probably invest 10, 20, maybe sometimes even 30% of my capital, but never so much that if the bet were to fail, that, you know, I'd be sort of bankrupt or anything. And that's pretty much how I still do things today. You know, if something's not worth a 5 or 10% position at least, then, you know, there's no point doing it at all. And it's also a great way to discipline yourself, because most companies, you know, look attractive through some, you know, from one perspective. If it's a great company, well, you might find it attractive as a great company. If it's a less great company, it might have a very cheap PE. So it's very easy to sort of end up owning pretty much everything, which is, of course, the recipe for mediocrity. So forcing yourself to say, okay, if I'm going to buy it, it has to be at least a sort of a 5 or 10% position, I think is a great way of disciplining yourself. And then the second part of the question is, you know, do we sort of, if we think the share price is going to go down, do we sort of sell in order to buy it back more cheaply? The answer to that is no. We'd love to be able to forecast share prices, but unfortunately we can't, so we have to leave that to somebody else.
I may add a few words on rebalancing. So if something goes up in price, you would say, okay, it's become less attractive, so you should sell something. And if something goes down, you should buy it. However, I at least want to add always value with my decisions, and I'm humble with regards to the quality of my decision making. So if something goes up 10%, that cannot be that's not a meaningful decision to sell that, because the precision that goes into the decision making is far lower than 10%, give or take. So you can only roughly value a company, and if something moves up 10%, it's still within the, it's just noise, I would say. You cannot really say, now this position is earning 15.8% and the other one is earning 15.6, and therefore you switch from the one that is earning 15.6 into the one that is earning 15.8. You should be humble about the quality of decisions that can be made. You don't know the future, so I try only to rebalance or to move from one stock to another if the decision is really a meaningful one. If I'm moving from a prospective, let's say, 13% return into one that is maybe a potential 20% return.
Great. There's a one there. Sure.
Now, my question is a little bit going into the direction, also follow-up question on some of the others. I mean, with Trump, we can expect to be some negative impact on the Chinese market because of the tariffs. Are you controlling for that at all, or are you saying, okay, no, we're not acting with politics in mind?
Yes, I think the question is around tariffs and Trump and whether that impacts our thinking about Chinese investments. Is that good summary?
Exactly.
Yeah, so, you know, so much gets written about China, and you know, most of it is sort of negative, and you know, there's so much noise. But there's one really big signal in my view, and that signal is the tariffs and the fact that many Western companies clearly feel they can no longer compete with Chinese companies. And although tariffs in the short term can create noise and, you know, maybe impact share prices, I think there's an incredible amount of signal in the fact that Chinese companies have got so good that the Western companies feel their only recourse is tariffs. And I would much rather own the company which everyone is trying to sort of protect themselves from, rather than the ones which are clearly losing the race, but hoping for sort of political help, because you know, the tariffs won't work. There's a million ways to get around them. You know, some things you might sort of put tariffs on might negatively impact one of your industries because they're an important supplier. So I don't think it will have any long-term impact. It will for sure impact share prices in the short run. But I think the biggest message to take from the tariffs is just how strong Chinese companies are.
And I would also say that these suggestions of putting up tariffs, I mean, Donald Trump always says he wants to balance the trade deficit and make it go away. But America is a very attractive investment market, and historically, whatever was flowing out of the trade balance came back in, as an investment into the country. And that the end result was that the dollar is where it is right now. And if you artificially want to get the trade deficit to zero, then you have to make sure that nobody from outside of the world invests in America anymore, and or the dollar will move up a lot. Or there is so much contradiction in the policies that were discussed during the election campaign. I'm in no position to say which one of these how these contradictions will be resolved.
Yeah, I mean it's very very contradictory. I mean, I'm fundamentally an admirer of China, but it is a dictatorship of sorts with obviously much of the power concentrated with Xi. And that being the case, I don't think that a company like TikTok should be in the effective ownership of the Chinese Communist Party. It's effectively a direct route into the brains of the population of the company that used the app. And yet that's the one decision which Trump seems to be keen to roll back. So there's a lot of contradictoriness, and I don't think that'll go away. But our strategy will just be to try and buy really good companies at attractive prices, and that should work out over time.
So I have a question concerning more like your style of investment, which I find it very interesting, because as a value investor, I'm often focused on companies that are cheap, let's say single digit multiples of some kind of earnings measure. So my question is, you buy companies at valuations sometimes that let's say an average value investor would consider expensive or not cheap at least. And so I think that's a very important signal for how you gain conviction on a stock. And I think that would be my question. How do you go about finding ideas? And what gives you, obviously it's very hard to have one answer, like on what gives you conviction of, but I would say what gives you conviction on buying sometimes at double digit multiples of some measure of earnings or owner's earnings? That would be.
Yeah, so for the younger people in the audience, the PE is if you take the price of a company and divide it by what it's going to earn this year, it gives you kind of an indication of whether a company is expensive or not. So if something trades on 30 times earnings, that's a 3% earnings yield, or if it's on 5 times earnings, it's a 20% yield. So it is a useful indicator of whether something provides value or not, but it is a shortcut. And it's a shortcut to finding the fair value of a company. And the fair value of the company is actually made up of the cash that it's going to earn between today and whenever it finishes as a business. And some companies have their cash very front end loaded, like International Petroleum, for example. It's going to earn a lot of cash in relative to its market cap in the coming years. And other companies, it's more back-end loaded. So Carvana, for example, relative to its market cap, is not going to earn very much cash in the next few years relative to its market cap. But we don't mind. We're quite happy to invest in both situations. But the important thing is always that you're buying this cash for less than it's worth, substantially less than it's worth.
Yeah, following up on that, as you I think wrote on your 15 years anniversary letter, an integral part of your strategy is having an investor base that supports you in that. But the point is that having a forecast on earnings or cash that is coming further in the future is harder, right? So there's been some way of gaining conviction on that it's harder compared to having front-loaded cash. I don't know if I'm explaining myself.
Yeah, I mean, time creates uncertainty, right? So if there was literally a suitcase with $1,000 in it here, and someone offered you for $500, you would know with complete certainty that you're going to make a 100% return. And of course, that situation almost never exists in real life. And so you're always sort of making a bet on the future. There's no way of avoiding that. what I found is the best way to sort of, and of course, the further you go into the future, the more riskier or more uncertain it gets, and actually not necessarily riskier. And the way to solve for that, in my view, is to try and focus on companies where the competitive advantage is increasing over time as opposed to decreasing. If you know a business is getting better and better, then you don't know exactly what the future is going to look like, but you know it's probably going to look better than it does today. And I would argue, for example, with Carvana, that's very much the case. There's all kinds of scale benefits that go into the business. If you think about the logistics, the data from the underwriting, the amount of inventory they have, all these things will, as the business gets bigger, it's going to get better. So although I don't know what exactly Carvana is going to earn in 5 years' time, I'm pretty confident it's going to be multiples of what it earns today.
I may add, as to the level of PEs, you always judge corporate profitability on two dimensions, basically. One is the sustainability dimension of the earnings power of a business, and the other one is the cash flow quality. The higher the percentage of your earnings that are converted to cash flow, the higher the valuation is that you can pay, and the more sustainable a business is, the longer the expected lifetime of the business is, the higher the valuation you can pay. And if you think back at a company like Coca-Cola, one of Buffett's most famous investments, and you think back to 1930s or so when they IPO'd. Now, what was the company really worth at the time, knowing what we know now? It's a lot, because they never grew very fast, but they grew for a very, very long period of time. And if a company doesn't die, and a good management always finds a way to grow 5% here and 10% there, and does that for 100 years, then a really big company emerges out of that, and a really high value would have existed had we known all that in the 1930s already. Now, by contrast, there are other companies who have to reinvest 100% of their earnings every single year because their return on invested capital is so low, and suddenly, after reinvesting for 20 years, they lose the competitive advantage and basically go from being a profitable growing business but with zero cash flow to one that is dying and restructuring, and basically the valuation was always zero. And when the market assigns a low valuation or a low multiple to a company, it's often a judgment about these two dimensions, either the cash flow is lacking or the sustainability of the whole business is in question.
We also, if there's any online questions, happy to take a few online questions. I think Nick is on the case there. So, yep, at the back, I think. Oh, who has the mic? Over there, sorry, yeah. There was also a hand at the back there. So. Yeah, please go ahead. Yep.
As investors, we tend to think more of mistakes when things go wrong. But last year you did great, so congratulations first. And I wonder, is there a particular mistake or a learning that you would like to share with us?
Well, I mean, I get things wrong the whole time, as you can imagine. I would say the most disappointing investment I've made is in Ryman Healthcare, which we sold last year. And that was a company which we owned for probably 6 or 7 years and end up selling at a loss. And I can't remember too many times where we've owned something that long and at least not got our money back. And if I think to what went wrong there, it was a company which was incredibly mission focused. So for those of you unfamiliar with it, it's a company that runs old people's homes and villages in New Zealand and Australia. And they still do an incredible job of creating a wonderful experience for these old, vulnerable people. But I think over time, the company became so obsessed with its mission that it kind of lost sight of making money, which is an important element for any business. You need to make money in order to reinvest and improve the product and pay suppliers and all that kind of stuff. And I saw the financials deteriorate throughout COVID, but there was so much happening in COVID with lockdowns and real estate transactions effectively having to cease and stuff. So there was always a reason to sort of justify that sort of financial deterioration, but With the benefit of hindsight, it was that the people were just not focused enough on the business side of things. So that's definitely a mistake that haunts me. Yeah.
Well, a mistake on my side I can talk about, it was basically investing too early in a company called HelloFresh from Germany, which I bought, where I bought the initial shares at 17 euros. And I underestimated a bit the dynamic. And maybe there was also a disconnect between the strategy that the management follows and the strategy that I think would be the right one for this business. Management hands out lots of coupons and educates people to cancel their subscription after a couple of boxes, whereas I think they should just cut prices by 20% and do away with the coupons and all this marketing and promote loyalty among their base. And maybe I kind of misjudged that. Management sent some signals in both directions, but what they really did, and you can see that from quarter to quarter, was basically continue with their old couponing strategies. Now, the business got cheap enough and I still hold it, but I would much prefer them to follow a more sustainable strategy. I think you have to make sure with every investment that you buy that management follows the strategy that you think is the right one for the business.
Hi, both Rob and Andreas, I'm happy to see you again. I have a bit more uncomfortable question back to Carvana. Earlier this year, there was a short report published by Hindenburg Research pointing to the questionable management practices in terms of accounting, some undisclosed related party transactions, and aggressive underwriting practices. I'm curious to know how you think about it, and maybe the second part of the question more broadly, what are your red lines when you look at the related party transactions in terms of integrity of the management assessment?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So we prefer not to discuss short reports per se. You know, the strategy of a short seller is to sort of, you know, highlight all the sort of the negatives and the risks and, you know, things that are potentially going wrong at a company, and that's fine. That's their prerogative. But, you know, effectively, if you start engaging with them, then you're sort of helping them to sort of perpetuate the story they're telling. So, you know, I won't comment on the report per se, but, you know, I've been invested in Carvana for many years now. I've got to know Ernie Garcia, who's the CEO and founder of the business, very well. And I, you know, can be as sure as you can possibly be, this is the most high quality individual life, one of the most high quality individuals I've met in my life. The idea that he would somehow do something sort of, you know, shady or you know, take money from the company or do something which benefits himself and damages the company is completely absurd. You know, I'm familiar with some of the sort of criticisms out there, but it's not something we pay too much attention to. Who's next?
Hey Rob, can we just do one from the internet really quick?
Yeah, sure.
There's a number, but effectively, could you spend a little more time talking about how you decide when you're wrong versus, you know, just the emotional side of that?
Yeah. Well, I think what helps actually is, you know, not working in a large team where you've perhaps sort of built, you know, for a long time been saying one thing and then it's sort of maybe psychologically awkward to then have to sort of row that back. You know, I make my investment decisions myself. Andreas makes his decisions himself. You know, of course, we discuss our thoughts on companies and what we like, what we dislike, where we see the risks, the opportunities. But ultimately, it's always our own decision. And we also put a lot of our own money, you know, my money is effectively in the fund, so whatever you own is what I own as well. And when that's the case, it's much easier, I would say, to change your mind than in more sort of corporate environment where maybe there's a disconnect between your sort of financial incentives and your kind of career incentives. So, you know, I hate losing money, as you can imagine. And if I think I've got something wrong, I think I'm normally pretty quick to acknowledge it. And I'm not embarrassed about that. I'd rather, if I've got something wrong, I'd rather find out sooner than later and then move on to something better. Yeah.
It's a tricky question because you should also not be too, you should not too easily decide that you're wrong. Sometimes I get the impression that I'm wrong. I maybe sell something and in the end it turns out I was always right. So you have to have some conviction in your own thinking. If your thinking was based on facts and you bent over backwards to be as objective as possible when making the decision, then maybe you're not as wrong after all as you may think after the share price goes down. So maybe you should believe in your own judgment.
Yeah, when a share price goes down a lot, it's normally not because of a very sort of clear fact which could be checked and then, you know, found out one way or another. It's normally about some vague sort of risk in the future or risk today, but where the outcome is not clear. So that you can never know for sure at that moment in time. You can't know one way or another. And you know, when that comes at the same time as the share price is going down and then you start focusing on this risk, it can feel like for a time like you've kind of got things wrong. But I think you have to sort of trust in the adaptability of the management, that even if they have made a mistake or face a risk, that they're going to find a solution for it. And also the adaptability of the business. And oftentimes, you know, things happen at companies I think very highly of, and you know, I don't know for sure how exactly it's going to play out, but I don't sell because I do sort of trust in the people and the business that they figure it out, and normally that works out quite well, actually. Dennis?
Hey, Rob and Andreas, thanks so much for getting this terrific gathering together year after year. We really appreciate it. I'm not sure that there's a prescriptive answer to this question that I have, but as a bottom-up stock picker, and I think most of us are here, how do you deal with changes in exogenous circumstances? And what I mean by that is 2022 is probably brutal for everybody, except for maybe the energy guys, but you've been waiting for 15 years to be up. But anyways, in a changing cost of capital regime, we're in a fairly benign and stable period right now, relatively. And let's say that here on out, we can expect like a 4.5% 10-year risk-free rate regime. But let's say the impact of tariffs and other inflationary policies lead to a circumstance where rates have to go to 7 or 9. Are there things that you've thought about to maybe avoid the risk of a catastrophic loss like in 2022, like many of us experienced? Is there things that you've thought about to mitigate those types of circumstances? And what does like a much higher cost of capital regime mean for your portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few sort of questions in there. And I mean, specifically to 2022, the narrative at the time, and probably even still today, was that all these sort of companies that suffered very greatly, it was because of sort of increased interest rates and increased inflation expectations. And I've never really bought into that argument, to be honest. You know, I think some of the companies we owned in 2022 are the best companies you could possibly own if you're expecting inflation to take off. You know, they have a lot of pricing power and, you know, capital light. So, you know, I think what happened in 2022, there was a panic, and probably the interest rates were, you know, kind of were what triggered that panic. But there wasn't any logical reason, in my view, why, you know, it affected so many of these sort of companies, which are now, you know, from today's perspective, you know, have gone from strength to strength. So I would say that's what I would say to sort of 2022. But and then in terms of, you know, what would we do differently if we thought interest rates were going to be 10%, you know, in a year's time or whatever, you know, that kind of goes into sort of macro and into certain, fundamentally, we don't think it can be predicted. And even if it could, sometimes you don't really know how it would impact share prices. So given that you don't know, I think the best you can do is buy the best quality business you can at the lowest possible price. And if you knew for certainty that interest rates were going to be so much higher in a year's time, I don't think that would change that formula at all.
Yeah. I may add, interest rates being at 10%, it would likely only happen if we have a lot of inflation. And corporate earnings are kind of inflation-protected assets. since companies can raise prices. So you should rather discount them with the real interest rate rather than the nominal one. So inflation and level of interest rate should not affect the value of businesses too much. Maybe they do, but they should, they don't, maybe they should affect the price, but not the value.
Hi, Rob. Obviously, you've done really well, and hindsight is a beautiful thing, but are there any lessons you've learned from not owning NVIDIA?
Well, it's a funny story here. So Norman Rentrop is sitting at the front here, and I've become, you know, Norman was a mentor to me, and in the same way he was a mentor to me, I became the mentor to his son. And the way you know, I effectively got to know Richard was that Norman holds this conference in Omaha every year, and the idea is that you know, the price of entry is that everyone has to bring one stock idea. And the particular year where Richard came for the first time, he had this incredibly passionate presentation about a company, and I was like very enthusiastic about his passion, but thought analytically there was plenty of improvement potential. So that was the reason that that was the reason I sort of took him under my wing. But the stock he presented was NVIDIA. I think that's my biggest NVIDIA lesson, is if a talented, smart 17-year-old comes to you saying, no, they're very enthusiastic about a company, just let them, leave them to it.
Yeah, well, NVIDIA was clearly a mistake of omission with hindsight, but maybe, I mean, sometimes you cannot recognize the mode of a business. And what I would say with regards to NVIDIA, they are selling to a few large customers, and whenever that happens, that limits pricing power. And that's true today as it ever was, just it has been temporarily put out of effect because of the supply situation for AI chips and the sudden spike in demand. But I'm not sure if longer term the economics will not dominate the business. You have basically three big customers, and each of these three big customers have their own silicon programs where they produce their own chips and will do everything to avoid paying so many billions of dollars to NVIDIA in the long run. So,
yeah, I think NVIDIA is not one that we would lose sleep over. I don't think we saw it coming, and there's no reason to even, you know, why we should have done. I mean, it's way beyond our circle of competence. I mean, I think it's things more like maybe Apple, when it was clear how dominant the iPhone was and how cheap the stock was. I think that was well within our circle of competence to recognize things like that. So that's probably more where I would lose sleep over. Yeah.
Well, ideally, you want a company that has lots of small customers, not a few big customers.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, Robin. Hey, Andreas. I believe both of you hold positions in Meta, are still holding them. And I'm just curious, in an update, do you think their competitive advantage is growing? And what do you think about the management? Is it moving in the right direction?
Yeah, I mean, we're huge admirers of Mark Zuckerberg. You know, I found it stressful to be a Meta shareholder for most of the last, you know, well, actually ever since I've owned it. You know, the share price was always going up and down, and there was all this sort of criticisms about the company. Whenever something went wrong in society, it was always supposedly Meta's fault. And I found that stressful, and I was just like a sort of an anonymous shareholder sitting in my office. So I just don't know where he gets the strength to sort of keep on plowing on despite all the kind of the stuff that gets written and talked about him, and financially clearly he doesn't need it. So he's someone that's clearly very, very you know, motivated by the task at hand as opposed to anything else. And you know, so we're huge admirers of what he's doing. Yeah.
I can only second that. Mark Zuckerberg is a really great manager. He has always adapted Meta to all the challenges that came up, and has done a really great job there. And maybe the one mistake he did, he was too quick at admitting guilt when somebody was throwing some allegation at them. But here he seems to have corrected course. And in terms of the valuation, the stock is not very highly valued, especially when you take out the losses of the metaverse division. They may be trading at a PE of 20 or so, maybe 21. I would think that we should really take out the losses of the metaverse decision, since either they succeed, then we're all happy, or they don't succeed, then after 5 years or so, these losses will come to an end. So losses never have the same sustainability dimension as earnings, positive earnings, to judge it in the sustainability dimension.
Would you say the moat is getting wider or narrower?
I would say it's getting wider since it's based on more platforms. Just 10 years ago, it was just a blue app, and then they added Instagram, and they added WhatsApp, and they are connecting those. So I think there is something in it for everyone.
It seems to uniquely benefit from AI.
Absolutely, yeah.
It seems, yeah, I'd say it's widening as well. Yeah.
Could you discuss how your fund is structured from a legal perspective? In Switzerland, what your dealings have been with FINMA, etc. Sorry for the boring question.
we are regulated in Switzerland by FINMA. Up until 2 years ago, we could do what we do unregulated, which, with hindsight, was a paradisical state. But unfortunately, we were thrown out of paradise. So we've been regulated for the last 2 years. I think it's had some positive impacts. So by far the most positive one for me, I was working on my own until we were regulated, and really in response to being regulated, it was clear we had much better chance of getting a license if we were two people rather than one. And so really for that sort of regulatory sort of motivation, Andreas and I got together, but it's something we probably should have done years before which we both enjoy. That's been incredibly positive, and for that reason alone, it was probably worth it. But it also there's a lot of box ticking involved. You have to sort of just create this sort of document trail of stuff which doesn't seem to be particularly relevant to the risk the customer takes, and they check whether you've kind of completed the documentation, not whether you're actually sort of avoiding the risk they're trying to prevent. So that stuff is quite tedious and probably going to increase over time, but you hear that in all kinds of sectors, not just our one. I mean, I do think regulation is a real problem of our times, because whenever something goes wrong, there's this big sort of public outcry, and people understandably want something to be done, and so it normally ends up with regulation. But no one sort of thinks of what are the trade-offs. Does the additional cost of regulation potentially create a worse outcome than in the world before you had the regulation? Because in reality, you can never have a perfect state. There's always going to be one thing go wrong, and unfortunately, people don't seem to have that greater appreciation for trade-offs. Yeah.
Don't have much to add. I would say we are complementing. We are quite complementary persons. Rob has different strengths than I have, and I have different ones than he has. So we work together very well in terms of mastering all these challenges. And with regards to regulation, I think RV Capital has gotten a better organization in certain terms. In other terms, I think the regulation doesn't prevent many risks. You can never make a regulation that is the right for every company, so you always have to make a set of rules that try to make the system more stable, and this set of rules may be the wrong set of rules for one company, or let's say not the wrong set of rules, but some of the rules may only apply to this one company, but still you have to follow all of them. So, but overall, I think it's still reasonable, and we're not too much distracted from investing.
Hi, Rob. What would you say the 2 to 3 back here?
What would you say the 2 to 3 characteristics that exceptional managers have that set them apart that are so obvious? You mentioned that exceptional people are a lot easier to spot, but what would you say the key things that they do that are so great are, and what advice would you give to CEOs to on what the key areas to focus on are?
Yeah, so I understand the question, but I slightly disagree with the premise. So I think sort of great managers and great businesses sort of grow up together, and you know, the business is often a reflection of the manager, and the manager is a reflection of the business. So the idea that there's sort of certain traits you can sort of transplant to someone and then send them into a business and go and do it, I think that's very, very tough. That's not something I think I would be able to spot or judge. For us, the sweet spot is when, you know, you find a sort of someone who's made a building a business their life's work, so you have this sort of 20, 30 year track record where you can see what they've done, you know, the values they have, how they've infused them into the business. And when you see that, it's sort of very, very obvious. But I would struggle to say there's sort of any sort of particular traits that you would necessarily look for. I mean, and you see that in reality. You have some managers like, you know, Steve Jobs, who from what I understand was a very difficult, almost unkind person to work with, but obviously built this incredible company in Apple. And then you have people with the exact opposite traits of, you know, being incredibly sort of, you know, kind and compassionate, and they also build great companies. So I don't think you can sort of reduce it to sort of traits per se. It's always goes hand in hand with the business.
Yeah, I agree. There's nothing in particular we look at.
Hi guys, thanks for having us here this weekend. My question was around how you prioritize your time, whether that's quietly reading in the office or talking with other investors, going to see companies, and if over time, how you value those buckets, has that changed at all?
Yeah, so for me, the part of the job which I enjoy the most is actually going out and meeting with the people that run the businesses and hearing from them about how they built the business. You know, a conversation like you heard me have with Will earlier on today, that's for me the highlight. But of course, you can only have that type of conversation if you've done your homework beforehand, and you know, no CEO was going to make time to speak with you if, you know, they're going to have to start right at the beginning to explain stuff. So. Yeah, I would say the visits are the most important and most value-added part, but there's a lot of time spent in the office before that, sort of learning about the companies, trying to figure out which ones are worth visiting, which ones aren't worth visiting, and yeah, I would say those are the two buckets. And that was, you know, like, without wishing to sort of defend the track record of 2022, but a big part of how I invest has always been going out and visiting the companies, you know, kicking the tires, looking at the CEO in the eye, and just meeting Daryl's eye here. And of course, that was impossible in 2020 and 2021. And so I felt, you know, there were things I potentially might have sold at the end of 2021, but where there was maybe I didn't have sufficient confidence that I'd sort of really sort of crossed the T's and dotted the I's on other things I was looking at.
Yeah, where we are, I think, both not spending a lot of time on discussing with other investors. I think we are spending more time on the companies and reading about them and setting up calls with them. And but talking too much to other investors, I think, is a potential cause of bias. You may have this investor in high regard and he likes a business, and then you think, okay, if this investor is a great investor and he likes the business, then maybe you should like it too. But you should always look at the facts and start from zero and build up your conviction about the business from zero, and not be influenced what other people think about it.
Yeah, I probably speak a little bit more than you do with other investors, although for me too, it's not too big a part. But in particular in China, many investors I enjoy talking to, several of them are in the room here today, and that's been an incredible, yeah, I'm very grateful for them for the time they take to explain businesses to me, and I certainly wouldn't have got to the level of knowledge I have today without those conversations. But that being said, at some point you have to buy a company, and when you buy a company, typically things go wrong at some point, and if you haven't sort of built your own inner conviction, you're likely going to panic when things go wrong. So ultimately, you always have to have your own conviction, and it can't be based on what other people have told you.
My question was about, you talked a lot about people and the inner conviction, mm-hmm. and we met many of the CEOs you invest personally in. Might that not also create kind of a problem? You become too attached to the company, and it might create kind of a hurdle to then sell the company, because you know the people behind the company, you know they're maybe good-hearted, but maybe the company is shifting in the wrong direction. How do you kind of detach, or how do you handle that potential risk?
Yeah, it's a great question, and of course, you know, if you have a close relationship with the CEO, then you're inevitably going to be less inclined to sell it, because it potentially harm that relationship, or you know, disappoint the CEO or whatever. So I would say that's definitely a factor, but you know, everything is always a trade-off in life. And if that's the downside, you know, what are the upsides of having a great relationship with the CEO? You're gonna know the company a lot better. You're gonna enjoy being invested with that company a lot more, which will make you more motivated to sort of visit it and study it carefully. And I think it will also, to the extent your own values are good and you sort of align yourself with CEOs you admire, it will be a great indicator of whether that CEO is a good one or not. So there are for sure some downsides, but I would say the upsides massively outweigh them.
I agree, and I tend to give CEOs the benefit of the doubt if they do something that I don't completely understand, maybe, or that I instinctively am critical about. But if I think of my Meta investment, when they acquired Instagram, they were criticized for acquiring a business with no revenues and for $1.3 billion, having only, I think, 50 employees and no revenues. And when they spent $20 billion on WhatsApp, they were again criticized. And the same was true for when Google acquired YouTube for $2.6 billion, I believe, and no revenues, no... And your instinct is, when a company does such a move, you don't completely understand it, and your instinct is to say, okay, I would never have bought that if that was a standalone business. But then again, you admire the CEO for what he has built, and he's done a great job there. And I think in this case, you should trust that he is doing the right thing, even if there are sometimes decisions that you cannot, from day one, understand.
Hello, Rob. Andrew. Thank you for having us. My question is regarding the Norway-based corporation income tax, which is north of 75%, I believe. So why you invested in Aker BP, like specifically based in Norway, considering there are many other oil and gas companies worldwide which are at very, very right valuation? And your thoughts on Occidental Petroleum, if you have researched. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, so the question was about the sort of the tax situation in Norway. And so the taxes are very high in Norway, I think 75 or even 80%. But that's not really too relevant to the investment decision, because you know, you price that into to the price you pay. So you know, effectively in Norway, you have an 80% shareholder in the company, which is the government, and that's totally okay. And the question is more around the sort of the stability of the tax regime, because you don't want to think you've got an 80% shareholder who suddenly becomes like an 85% shareholder or something, and with the equivalent loss to your stake. So the stability is much more important than the absolute level, because you could just price the absolute level in. But actually, while we're on the subject of Norway, it's actually an incredibly favorable tax regime, which greatly incentivizes investment. So they have this system, you know, they were, especially in COVID, they were very keen to encourage investment. So they have the system that, you know, obviously when you start to develop an oil field, you have a lot of cost and no revenue. And then in most regimes, when you start to make money, you can use those tax losses to reduce your tax. Whereas in Norway, you get a cash refund for those tax losses from day one, which obviously de-risks projects massively. So it's actually, I would say actually the tax regime in Norway is a big factor in favor. And actually that's like a great sort of anecdote about Aker BP is, so when COVID hit and the oil industry looked like it was gonna shut down, the Norwegian government created these sort of tax incentives to encourage investment. And Aker BP had a lot of sort of projects that it sort of had in its sort of in its pipeline, and it went all in to sanction those projects and, you know, benefit from these sort of tax subsidies, whereas other companies which are sort of maybe didn't have the backup of strong shareholders, more maybe focused on cash flow, weren't as aggressive in investing, and, you know, that's what we love to see. Yeah. And Occidental, I don't have an opinion.
Thank you.
Well, I agree. I mean, these taxes that are charged in Norway are a variable expense. You are more concerned about fixed expenses, and we value the 20% that we own and not the 80% that the government owns. And as you described, CapEx is immediately tax deductible, and therefore it's not so bad as it looks at first sight, maybe.
Thank you.
Hello everyone, I'm Francesca Preda from Sorrento Coast, Italy. Thanks for taking my question. To be here is a big honor. My question regarding how to become a better investor. If Robert and Andrea have a time machine and could back in the time and to meet a little Robert and Andrea, which advice will give to him how to become a better investor, which we dance a part to follow? Thank you.
Yeah, I like the question. I don't think there's any shortcuts though. I mean, obviously you could go back in time and tell yourself to, you know, if I could sort of speak to myself of 20 years ago and could just give one piece of advice, it'd probably be, you know, buy software. I mean, software has just been, but unfortunately you don't have a time machine. And I do think the way you learn investing and become a better investor is actually experience markets and what they do to your psychology. You know, you have to have been through a few big downturns to understand, you know, what happens. You know, in hindsight, it always looks super easy, you know, when everything was at rock bottom in 2009 in the financial crisis and, you know, great companies trading on 5x earnings, and it kind of looks simple. Just, you know, I would have bought them if I was in that situation. I can imagine a lot of people think, but in practice, when prices get that low, there's some very genuine concerns in the world and risks, and so it's much harder than it looks, primarily from a psychological perspective, I would say. So, and the only way to learn that is just to invest through time. So I don't think there's any sort of shortcuts that you could take, but my advice would just be to just study as many industries as you can, study them over time, because how they develop over time is actually more important than at any moment in time. And the great thing is there's always a new company you can look at, a new industry. So it's something you can continue doing your entire lifetime.
My advice to Andreas would be trust in your own judgment. Because I have a tendency I had a tendency some 20 years ago to listen too much to others. I instinctively thought software was a great industry and worthwhile to invest in, and then I listened to people who said no, it's too short-lived and too expensive, and it's technology and you shouldn't invest in technology and things like that, which deep inside me was never very convincing, but I convinced myself, well, these are much more knowledgeable people than I am, much more experienced people than I am, maybe I should take their judgment more seriously. And that was a mistake. I should have just followed my own thinking and trust in it. Yeah.
Rob, time for one more.
Okay, one last question. We're just past the hour. I know everyone's
I don't know who this is directed to, but first of all, thanks very much for having us.
Yes.
I just would like a little bit of color to the investment in Deere & Co., please.
Okay, that's Andreas's investment, so what?
Which one?
John Deere.
John Deere, yes. Okay.
Well, on the surface, it sounds like a very boring company. It was founded in 1871. And so it's 150 years old or so. And normally you would think a company that old and that big will grow very slowly, have not great returns on invested capital since they are dealing with large and expensive machinery and lots of metal and so on. But when you look at the numbers, you see a completely different picture. It's an asset-light business. If you take out the financial part, it's a fast-growing or reasonably fast-growing business. It's totally dominant in its industry. Great return on invested capital, great cash flow dynamics. Management is top-notch. They've had, I think, only 9 or 10 CEOs since it was founded. They take a very long-term view. They started investing in software and AI and GPS technologies 20 years ago, long before everyone else in the industry, and they are now the market leader in precision farming and able to monetize some of the value that they create for the farmers. For farmers, fertilizer, for instance, is a big expense, and if they manage to cut back the use of fertilizer a little bit because there is less overlap in the track that the tractor or the combine goes over the field, then that's a real monetary benefit, and John Deere can monetize some of that. And now competition is just now trying to catch up by cooperating with Trimble, but John Deere has done that for many years, and they basically go for the same kind of engineers, for the same software engineers that Apple and Google go for, and they have their own development centers in Silicon Valley, and people work for them, even though they pay a little bit less maybe than Google or Apple, but because they're not placing, they're not working on a slightly better placement of the ad, improving the ad placement maybe by a tenth of a percent. And that's basically a success when you look back over your last year. Then you can claim you improved the ad placement a little bit versus you helped making a hard job, which the farmer does, a little bit more easy. You have a tangible product that you created and you helped feeding the world. So that's a great pitch, and people are loyal. It's a great culture.
Yeah, what's impressed me about it is the way sort of technology is really a tailwind for the business. So we saw this video where they even have little lasers on the tractors which can shoot the bugs. So which obviously saves you using poisons and that kind of stuff. It's an impressive case. Well, difficult to believe, but we're already past 12 o'clock and the mountain is waiting us.